Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza, working on this pre-recorded program very much. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, June 9th, 2021. The U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan says the Troika countries are keen on supporting the Sudan peace talks in Juba.
The ability to resolve differences through dialogue rather than violence. And four, freedom of religion. The Juba Peace Agreement does provide for religious freedom.
And the spokesman of the South Sudan People's Defense Force says the military will investigate Tuesday's shootout between two officers at the military headquarters in Juba.
He shot me two gunshot wounds on his right hand, another one on his shoulder, and another one that went through his mouth.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A recent review of the United Nations mission in South Sudan by independent groups identified various challenges facing the mission. Key among the challenges is airlift capacity, military hardware, country consent, and the number of the troop contributing countries. I spoke with the new head of the United Nations mission in South Sudan, Nicholas Haysom, via telephone from Juba to understand how he intends to address these challenges in order to improve the capacity of the mission to keep peace, protect civilians, and put off threats to peace and security in South Sudan.
We need to continuously interrogate whether we're having the maximum impact and how we can make best use of our not inconsiderable security resources. And that will go to the methodology of our operation, the effectiveness of our forward operating bases and so on. I've only been in the mission a month, but I've earmarked that as an exercise we will be doing in the near future. As regards what we can do, I think people are a little ungenerous and fail to recognize just how much the mission does with its hundreds of patrols every week in projecting some level of international presence, which in itself has some deterrence and some capacity to provide safety and security. Is it enough? Probably not enough, given the numbers that we have to hand at any one stage. But I think we are also expanding our understanding of what safety and security means beyond peacekeeping to include convening engagements between communities with a history of conflict and helping them reach agreement on the arrangements by which they can live together in peace and harmony. And quite frankly, the political agreements between communities are more effective than the guns and gunpowder required to effect an end to intercommunal violence.
You are saying political agreement between the communities is the best approach to silencing the guns. But let us look at the Equatorial region here. Church leaders have been sounding alarm bells that communities in Lanya, not far from Juba, have been under constant attacks. What is the mission doing to mitigate these issues around Equatorial especially? We are talking about Lanya here and other parts of central Equatorial.
Well, first of all, you would need to appreciate that the responsibility for protecting civilians doesn't rest with the UN. It rests with the host country. A host country is expected to protect its own citizens. We play a supplementary role, particularly where it's incapable or unable to do it. And in those particular areas, we've been particularly active in patrolling, and we are intending to step up our patrolling, particularly because of the threat to the lifeline between Juba and Namule as an arterial route for the country, and the threat that current levels of criminality are posing to it.
Talk to me about country consent. It's my understanding that the mission operates with the consent of the host country. Do you have the consent to go to places where civilians are under threat?
This has been an issue that we've been engaging with the host country for some time. We now have a situation where we can more or less reach about 90% of the country, provided we follow a particular route, which is not a permit-based approach, but a notification-based approach. John, we still have problems in some areas, in Western Equatoria and Western Barra Bazaar. And we're in the process, as we speak, of trying to find a way of clearing out these problems with the host government so that we have complete freedom of movement. It should be mentioned that each and every time we are blocked, we report it to the Security Council, which maintains a full index of breaches of the Status of Forces Agreement and of the mandate.
Let us talk about the prospects for the smooth implementation of the 2018 peace agreement. It is my understanding when missions are established, they focus more on nation building, building institutions, building capacity of the belligerent forces so that they can operate effectively in implementing a peace agreement. How do you see yourself playing this role moving forward?
We are already playing that role. We play it extensively by bringing together different parts of government to develop common visions at the state level, but also increasingly at the national level, bringing together opposition and government senior political leaders to define their work program and their objectives ahead. We're also doing this at the level of governors and county commissioners. We think it's particularly important. It complements the work we're doing, bringing community leaders together to resolve their conflicts, and the work we're doing at the national level to help expedite the implementation of the peace agreement writ large. In other words, elections and constitution making itself. So we have a full raft of activities and engagements. How much progress we make will depend largely on the receptivity of government and the political environment, as well as the attitude of the political elite towards completing the transition.
That's Nicholas Haysom, the head of the UN mission in South Sudan. In the second part of this interview, which airs tomorrow, Haysom talks about the various opportunities available for the international community and South Sudanese leaders. South Sudan's military spokesperson says the country's military will investigate an incident in which a senior military officer and his bodyguard shot at each other on Tuesday. Major General Lul Roy Kwang says the Inspector General of the South Sudan People's Defense Force, General Peter Dor Munjur Gatluak, and his bodyguard, Second Lieutenant Gatluak Riak, sustained non-life-threatening injuries and were admitted at a military hospital in Juba. Kwang says the two officers violated a military law, adding that they will be interrogated after being discharged from the hospital. For VOA News, Winnie Chirino reports from Juba.
Major General Kong says both SSPDF Inspector General Lieutenant General Peter Dormajur Gatluak and his bodyguard Second Lieutenant Gatluak Riak sustained non-life-threatening injuries during the shootout and were rushed to Giada Military Hospital following the incident. Kong says he visited the general last night at the hospital and again today at his home shortly after he was discharged. He says General Gatluak was shot four times.
He shot me. Two gunshot wounds on his right hand, another one on his shoulder, and another one that went through his mouth and exited on his neck. He also suffered some cuts from glasses that were shattered. The bodyguard sustained one gunshot wound to his abdomen.
Kong says he failed to visit the bodyguard because the two men were receiving treatment from different wards and that he had a lot of work he was following up on yesterday in relation to the incident. He says he did have the injured bodyguard's number to reach out to him yesterday, but now that he is not busy, he intends to visit Second Lieutenant Riak. General Kong says his information about the incident has been one-sided from the point of view of the general, who claims weapons were discharged as a result of minor issues between some of his bodyguards and one of their commanders.
The person who is in second in command of control of bodyguards is the one that was having some issues with some of soldiers and his command. And IGP came in as the overall commander at that unit. He was basically advising him on the need to be a little bit cautious in handling their affairs, their daily affairs, things to do with command and control, their welfare. Probably, maybe, he did not understand properly the context. Or what his inspector general meant.
Kong says he has heard contradictory statements about what took place. He says the inspector general told him it was the bodyguard who started shooting him. But according to other sources within Bilfarm, the inspector general first fired his weapon at the bodyguard. Kong says the two officers will be interrogated after both are discharged from the hospital to establish the chain of events that led up to the incident. He says both officers violated military law by taking up arms against each other. When asked what charges the officers face, Kong says the army will follow the SPLA Act.
Our SPLA rules and regulations, SPLA Act 2009, clearly spells all the areas, you know, and what kind of a punishment should be given to someone who had violated the standing rules, administrative rules. We have also have penalties that are given to those who have violated military rules. So when the time comes for investigation, be subjected into a legal process. Of course, the director of military justice with our legal teams will come in to know exactly the violations of use of firearms and put this into legal perspectives. But at the moment, the two, of course, violated some of our rules and regulations.
Kong says no one else was injured during the incident because the two officers fought in the inspector general's office before jumping out the window. Kong says there is need to train and create awareness among security forces about the penalties they face when relations between senior military officials and subordinates are violated. Jacob Chol, a professor of political science at the University of Juba, says it was a sad incident for a senior official and his junior to shoot at each other at military headquarters, a place that should control the misuse of firearms. He says any shooting in the country often brings panic to the public, knowing that there are all kinds of guns in the community. He says any shooting in the country is a violation of the ceasefire that was signed by the parties and that both old and new soldiers must be well trained on how to handle disputes. Chol says guns should be left at the reception or at the gate to avoid such incidents.
It would be good that they have to review gun policy at the ministry so that people don't carry guns, only the designated security at the entrance or maybe within the ministry at a certain point should be the one carrying guns so that the guns are not carried by generals. Because after all, why do you carry a gun when you are in the office? Your security provided by who? By the ministry and by the government. And the government is who? The government are those soldiers that are at the gate.
Chol says he has seen several people carrying guns on the street, which he says is risky given South Sudan's history of war and how people have been traumatized for years. He says it is important for soldiers to leave their guns at the barracks or at a store rather than moving with them on the streets, because any time a soldier is provoked, he may turn to his weapon to fight. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sirino in Juba.
The United Nations Special Envoy to Sudan has renewed the commitment of Troika countries to fully support the Juba Peace Agreement aimed at silencing guns in Sudan and building democratic institutions in the country. Ambassador Donald Booth says the Troika countries are keen on freedoms, justice, security reforms, and economic recovery. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Is speaking during a ceremony at which the Troika countries and the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, signed the Juba Peace Agreement as witnesses in Khartoum on Tuesday, Ambassador Booth said the United States, the United Kingdom, and Norway are committed to supporting the implementation of the Juba Peace Deal and to ensuring that a democratic transformation is realized in Sudan. Booth, who signed on behalf of the U.S. government, urged the signatories to the Juba Peace Deal to ensure that basic freedoms for Sudanese citizens are guaranteed and basic services are delivered to citizens as is stipulated in the agreement.
Freedom from want, the ability to feed, to clothe, and to educate your family. freedom of speech, the ability to challenge authority, to challenge the way things have been done, and the ability to resolve differences through dialogue rather than violence. And fourth, freedom of religion. The Juba Peace Agreement does provide for religious freedom, for separation of state and religion.
Ambassador Booth says the transitional government needs to accelerate the process of the transitional justice to ensure that victims of conflict in Sudan get justice.
They need to see accountability, and the Juba Peace Agreement provides for that, both via transitional justice and through the Special Court for Darfur.
Speaking at the same ceremony, Professor Manasseh Lamole, the representative of South Sudan's government, praised the Troika countries for their continuous and genuine support for the peace process in the region. He reiterated the commitment of the government of South Sudan in bringing all Sudanese parties to the negotiating table and to achieve peace in their country.
The steps taken by the United States of America, United Kingdom, and Norway and eager to append their signatories to the Juba Peace Agreement is commendable and will surely consolidate these great gains for this country and for the world.
Al-Hadi Idris, the current chair of the Sudanese Revolutionary Front, a coalition of armed groups which signed the Juba Peace Deal with the Sudanese government, welcomed Troika and IGAD support.
We greatly welcome this signing that will assure support and strengthen the implementation of the agreement and contribute to lasting peace in Sudan. This historic moment marks an important milestone in the implementation of the Juba Agreement.
Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok says he too appreciates the support of the Troika countries and IGAD in Sudan's peace process. Hamdok says, with the help of its partners, the transitional government is determined to achieve peace in Sudan, to see that justice is served, and to ensure that economic institutions are strengthened.
The way to the future and to peace is not easy, and we cannot achieve this alone as the transitional government, and we cannot allow it to be implemented by others on behalf of the Sudanese. The transitional government, with a strong will, good faith, and determination, is ready to engage with partners locally, regionally, and internationally in order to make the transitional period a success and to achieve the objectives of the December Revolution.
The Sudanese Transitional Government and the Sudanese Revolutionary Front signed the Juba Peace Agreement in October 2020. Another round of peace talks between the government and the holdout rebel group SPLM North faction, led by Abdulaziz Al-Hilu, is underway in South Sudan's capital, Juba. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, how effective is COVID vaccine on young people? That story is lined up after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
is there something about yourself that you would like to change?
Definitely not. No, because at least I know my life has been good. I've not been entertaining bad company. So to maybe to change my life, I need to start making at least new friends again.
Life is all about learning. We learn every day. So in as much as we are still breathing, there are things we need to shed off.
Currently, I would like to change my tummy. I'm growing a pot belly. So I'm exercising. I've bought an abdomen machine that's helping me to deal with it. And I want to lose weight, probably 5-8 kilos.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Tests have started around the United States and around the world to determine the effectiveness of Pfizer coronavirus vaccine in children aged 5 through 11. AP's Ed Donahue reports.
The tests are being done in 26 states, including Louisiana. Adam Brightson in New Orleans is getting the shot.
Like everybody, they're ready for COVID to go away as best it can. And me and my wife both feel like the vaccines are the right way to go.
Families won't know for 6 months whether their children were actually vaccinated. At that point, if they didn't get the vaccine, the children will have the chance to get the shot.
And there's been minimal side effects from my understanding, so I was very prepared to have them participate.
7-year-old Russell Bright wants the vaccine to work.
I've been trying to try to do all this stuff. See my friends more.
Children 12 to 15 can now get the Pfizer vaccine. I'm Ed Donahue.
From US, we move to Australia, where law enforcement officials in Australia say worldwide raids against organized criminal gangs have resulted in hundreds of arrests after a 3-year inquiry using an app designed by the US Federal Bureau of Investigation. The U.S. agency and Europol, the European Union's law enforcement body, will present their own findings on Tuesday. For VOA News, Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Suspected members of drug trafficking gangs have been arrested in 18 countries across Asia, North and South America, Europe and the Middle East. Australia was one of the first jurisdictions to reveal the sting, codenamed Operation Ironside, on Tuesday. Police there said they disrupted drug running operations and prevented mass shootings, including a plot to attack a cafe with a machine gun. More than 200 people have been detained in raids across the country by 4,000 police officers. Large amounts of drugs, cash and some weapons were seized in an investigative operation named Operation Ironside. Australian Federal Police Commissioner Rhys Kershaw.
We allege they are members of outlaw motorcycle gangs, Australian mafia, Asian crime syndicates and serious and organised crime groups. We allege they have been trafficking illicit drugs into Australia at an industrial scale. Sadly, criminal gangs are targeting Australia because it is one of the most profitable countries in the world to sell drugs.
Since 2018, authorities in Australia, New Zealand and the United States have used an encrypted app known as Anom to track organised crime. The technology was designed by the FBI. Undercover agents distributed devices with the application to criminals, who then passed it on to their underworld associates. It allowed investigators to read millions of messages that described alleged murder plots, mass drug import plans, and other schemes. 35 people were detained in New Zealand. Australian authorities say their crime-busting raids were the nation's largest police operation. Prime Minister Scott Morrison says it's been a real success.
Operation Ironside has now charged hundreds of alleged offenders, seize millions of dollars in criminal proceeds, remove weapons from our streets and save lives, and will continue to. It is an ongoing operation.
Australian investigators say that while the raids were successful, they were just the beginning and that efforts to combat criminal gangs would continue. They did caution, however, that while individuals and syndicates involved in alleged crime had been apprehended, there would always be someone else wanting to replace them in the illicit drug trade. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
As it marks the World Ocean Day, the World Meteorological Organization warns the continued rise of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere is threatening the ecosystem of the world's oceans. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Carbon dioxide, the primary greenhouse gas emitted from human activities, is the key driver of global warming. Scientists say CO2 emissions hang around in the atmosphere for a very long time, from 300 to 1,000 years. WMO spokeswoman Claire Nullis says because of this long lifetime, rising emissions of CO2 will have a profound impact on future generations.
We're not just talking about one or two, we're talking about many generations will be committed to seeing more impacts of climate change. So that means rising temperatures, more extreme weather, melting ice, rising sea level, and all the associated impacts.
The ocean absorbs around 23% of the annual atmospheric emissions of carbon dioxide and acts as a buffer against climate change. Latest data from the Atmospheric Monitoring Station in Hawaii, the Mauna Loa Observatory, find a considerable rise in CO2 emissions in May compared to those in previous years. Nullis says this is causing ocean acidification, a phenomenon that will have a very serious impact on ocean ecosystems.
This has obviously a very damaging effect on marine ecosystem systems, coral reefs. The ocean also absorbs 90% of the excess heat from human activities, and as a result, ocean heat is at a record level, and large parts of the ocean are seeing heat waves every year.
A recent report by two UN agencies notes at least 25% of the world's live coral has been lost in the last three decades due to ocean acidification and marine heat waves. If the trend continues, the agencies warn it could lead to the loss of functional coral reef ecosystems around most of the world by mid-century. That has huge consequences as coral reefs provide essential habitat for 25% of all marine life, estimated at well over 1 million species. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That's all we prepared for you today. We'd love to hear what you think about this program. Our WhatsApp number is +1 202 630 8011. We now leave you with the song Bira Bira by Unique Arafati.
Yeah! Dana Lela Unique Arafati! Futuring Kodi Kodi Mash! Bira Bira! I'll see you!
Bira Bira! Bira Bira! Bira fetisu, bira bira, itabiligo. Bira bira fetisu, bira bira, itabiligo. Bira bira fetisu, bira bira, itabiligo. Ya hajana dero fi dunia de getala mini ko tarabuna. Ageni bira fetisu bira, rabuna takio buwe dileta. Mata ali gugeli bataki fom fom, mata shilu iya haja guam guam. Ageni bira, veti subira, rabona taki opu edileta. Bira bira, veti su, bira bira, itabiligo. 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 Ngachi ni kimadosu kwa drono ya Keri luri jasi Mililiaro ya matuliaro Alumiro kozo damiri Lialiaro Milia Lialiaro Mili Lialiaro Milia Lialiaro Miusuda Bira bira fetisu Bira bira itabiligo Bira bira fetisu Bira bira itabiligo Bira bira fetisu, bira bira itabiligo. Bira bira fetisu, bira bira itabiligo.
We've been listening to Unique Arafati with the song Bira Bira, which literally means go slow. I'm John Tanza. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places to protect you and others from getting COVID-19. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Mira mira fetisu mira mira itabidi go Mira mira fetisu mira mira itabidi go
Oh signore niko na mali oh kadhani nimeiba Nimomba Mola wangu leo amenibariki Kike na komba ndugu yangu pia Mola wako muombe